Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
This episode of Suffer the Little Children podcast is sponsored by Podcorn, the marketplace connecting podcasters to amazing podcast sponsorship opportunities such as host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. I'm just getting started with Podcorn myself, but I'm really excited to be able to connect my listeners with products and services I think you'll find valuable. With Podcorn, there's no middleman. Podcasters of all sizes can browse and choose opportunities right on the platform, set our own rates, and collaborate with brands directly without any exclusivities. You never give up any rights to your podcast, and Podcorn is there to support you at every step and ensure you're protected and compensated for the work you do for brands. The marketplace mission is to give podcasters like me transparency, creative freedom, and full control of how and when we monetize. As you all know, my ultimate goal is to be able to devote myself full-time to the podcast and the blog, and working with Podcorn brings me one step closer to reaching that goal. If you're a podcaster, click the link in my show notes to sign up for Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities for yourself. This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 48, Avery Lee Hobbs, part 2. In episode 47, I started telling you the story of 4-year-old Avery Lee Hobbs, whose mother broke her skull as an infant, only to regain custody of Avery a few years later. In this episode, I'm going to tell you about the horrific and preventable end of this precious little girl's short life, the prosecution of her mother, and the many ways Avery's paternal grandmother is working to turn her tragic death into something positive. You'll also hear my interview with Avery's mama, Tammy Risen, who was gracious enough to speak with me for the podcast. Tammy, who calls herself a granny with a mission, is truly a force to be reckoned with, and she refuses to let Avery's death be in vain. This is a story of a mother who can only be described as evil, of domestic partner and child abuse, of ineptitude and corruption in the systems designed to protect children, and of a family who first fought to save Avery's life, then fought for justice for her, and now fight to protect other children like her. This is part 2 of the tragic, infuriating, preventable story of Avery Lee Hobbs. My sources for this week are the same as last week: WLWT5, Local 12, WCPO Cincinnati, Fox 19, The Cincinnati Inquirer, The Inquisitor, The Mihovic Rosenacker Funeral Home, and the book In the Best Interest of a Child by Tammy E. Risen, Avery's grandmother. If you haven't yet listened to episode 47, Avery Lee Hobbs, Part 1, I recommend you do that before listening to this one. Before I get into Part 2 of Avery's story, I want to give a few shout-outs to my newest patrons: Alexis from Phoenix, Arizona, Nicole from Canetillo, Texas, Lauren from South Australia, and Rachel from Frederick, Maryland. Thank you all so much for your monthly pledges, which bring me closer to my ultimate goal of permanently devoting myself full-time to the podcast and the blog. between researching, writing, recording, editing, mastering, graphic design, marketing, managing social media, responding to email, and all the other tasks that go into this, it's more than a full-time job in itself. Of course, to support my family once this pandemic is over, I'll need to work full-time, which would leave me with very little time to devote to Suffer the Little Children. I'm absolutely not looking to profit from this. My only goal is to support myself and my kids while giving the podcast and the blog my full attention. Thank you to all of my patrons for getting me closer to that goal with each and every pledge, and to today's sponsor, Podcorn, for helping me do the same. One more quick thing before I start what will probably end up being quite a long episode. In episode 12, I covered the story of Amari Boone, a 3-year-old boy who died of blunt force trauma on Easter Sunday of last year while under CPS care. If you read my blog, you might know that his caretakers were arrested on January 22nd. They've both since bonded out, and they were only charged with injury to a child, not murder. This case is an absolute mess, and I've been posting about it all over social media for the past week. When you get a second, please visit the podcast's Facebook page and watch the video I posted on January 30th entitled Murder Investigation of Amari Boone, which I've pinned to the top of the page. And please share the post or at least the YouTube link as far and wide as you can. Justice is not being done for this little boy. And the more public outcry there is, the harder it will be for the Tarrant County, Texas, criminal district attorney to keep sweeping Amari's case under the rug. If this wasn't incredibly important, I wouldn't ask, but Amari's life mattered. Now, I'll tell you the rest of Avery's story, and you'll also hear from Avery's mama herself, Tammy Risen, who continues to work toward keeping Avery's memory alive while helping other children, like the granddaughter Tammy called Cupcake. As I mentioned last week, after Tammy and Jonathan Risen, Avery's paternal grandparents, appealed the verdict handed down by Magistrate Peters in the matter of Avery's custody, the verdict was upheld by Judge John Williams in March of 2015, which was to award Avery's mother, then 23-year-old Brittany Roll, custody of the little girl. As I'm sure you remember from last week, this was despite the constant reports of abuse and injuries incurred by Avery while in her mother's care during visitations. The injuries, which grew more and more severe as time progressed, included sunburns, bruises, scrapes and abrasions, teeth marks, cigarette and lighter burns, and even bruises and bite marks on and around Avery's buttocks and genitals. There was other evidence of abuse, too. Avery lived in a constant state of high alert. She had made statements indicating a high probability of sexual abuse by her mother to Stephanie, her caseworker from the Hamilton County Department of Jobs and Family Services, or JFS, to Julie Pedersen, her guardian ad litem, and to Suzanne, her mediation therapist. These claims were summarily dismissed by all three women, who shared responsibility for Avery's health, her safety, and her very life. This 4-year-old girl was accused of being a liar by these three grown women who could easily see the evidence right in front of their eyes. Tammy constantly had to rebuy stuffed bunnies for Avery, whose favorite toys were repeatedly thrown away when they reached Brittany's petty hands. On more than one occasion, Tammy rescued plush bunnies from the trash, and more than once, she had to sew ears back on the bunnies after Brittany spitefully tore them off. It wasn't just Tammy and Jonathan reporting abuse, despite the attempts of caseworker Stephanie to paint them as conniving grandparents attempting to steal Brittany's child because they couldn't conceive one of their own. One doctor called Hamilton County's child abuse hotline 241-KIDS at least twice. At a doctor appointment on Avery's second birthday, the physician noted bruises on Avery's forehead and between her buttocks. Avery's daycare provider, Miss Kim, wrote in February of 2015 that Avery told her, "Mommy smacks her head and pulls her on the potty." Miss Kim also wrote at one point of Brittany herself telling her during a conversation about Avery,
"I could choke her because she won't listen."
Yet Brittany, who was convicted and spent 6 months in jail in 2012 for fracturing infant Avery's skull, was ultimately awarded custody of this battered little girl in March of 2015. Guardian ad litem Julie Pedersen even wrote in a review report to the court,
"This GAL has no concerns with this placement."
Still, even after Brittany gained custody of Avery, JFS asked Tammy and Jonathan to continue caring for her until they believed Brittany was ready to be a full-time mother. Wasn't that what the magistrate's custody ruling and the upholding of that verdict by Judge Williams supposed to indicate, that Brittany was suitable and equipped to mother her child? After the appeal was finished, Brittany's attorney filed a motion against JFS's insistence that Avery remain in the care of the Risens. On May 15, 2015, Jonathan received a phone call from Miss Kim, the daycare provider, telling him that Brittany had shown up and taken a screaming Avery without notice. She said that despite Avery's vehement insistence that she didn't want to go with her mother, Brittany dragged her 4-year-old daughter out of the building and down the sidewalk, throwing her into her mother Sandra's waiting vehicle. Avery never spent another night with the Risens in the home she had known since she was less than a month old. Throughout the summer of 2015, the Risens attended multiple mediation sessions as they fought for visitation with their granddaughter. Brittany, who railed against Tammy seeing Avery at all, had the full support of Stephanie, who had, just months before, personally asked Tammy to continue caring for Avery. Fortunately, Magistrate Peters was, for once, the voice of reason, demanding that Brittany allow visitation to the grandparents who had done so much for Avery over the previous 4 years. Before the end of that particular hearing, Tammy wrote in her book, the magistrate also issued a blanket warning statement that if anyone submitted a single additional allegation that could endanger Brittany's custody of Avery, the accuser would face fines and jail time and lose the right to visitation with Avery. He ordered the stunned grandparents not to photograph or report any of Avery's injuries to JFS and honored Brittany's wishes to forbid anyone from taking Avery to any medical provider or altering Avery's appearance in any way, including clothing changes. I'd love to hear Magistrate Peters explain what, besides abuse at Brittany's hands, could possibly explain her reasoning for those demands. For whatever reason, these warnings from the magistrate were never documented in the official court transcript.
Very interesting,
but not very tasteful.
Just so we're all clear, a court official threatened to inflict serious penalties on anyone who had the audacity to advocate for an abused child, including documenting or photographing any injuries that child incurred.
No, nothing wrong here.
Ultimately, Tammy and John were granted 3 visits with Avery per month, consisting of 5 hours each. Brittany herself would choose the day and time of each visit. Of course, because she's both spiteful and evil, Brittany chose days and hours when she knew Tammy would be on the clock at the hair salon where she worked. Avery's father, Jamie, whose divorce from Brittany was finalized in February of 2015, had lived for quite a while with his paternal grandparents, John and Lee Hobbs, and he considered them practically surrogate parents. The family, and Jamie in particular, was devastated when Grandma Lee passed away in April of 2015 at the age of 77, followed by Papa John in September. In fact, this family would be stricken with an unimaginable number of losses over the next few years, from parents to grandparents to close friends. But none would destroy them on a deeper level than the one we're here to talk about today. Shortly after Brittany took custody of Avery, she moved into the house at 1232 Beach Avenue in Cincinnati with Charles Mays III, the man Avery claimed in audio clips I played last week had kicked her down, and possibly the father of the child Brittany was pregnant with at the time. This child, her third, is totally and absolutely unaccounted for at this time, which you'll hear a little bit more about during my interview with Tammy. Apparently, Sandra claims Brittany miscarried the baby, who she named Jacob, at about 7 months gestation, but no one knows what became of the child's remains if that is the case. It's just one more bizarre and unfathomable detail in a case already full of them. With each subsequent visitation, Avery began showing up with more and more marks and bruises and injuries, even missing more and more hair as time went on. Once again, the Risens were not legally allowed to photograph the injuries or report them to the agency dedicated to the protection of children. The only person they were allowed to talk to about the abuse was the abuser herself, who I think we can all agree by now is a pathological liar to say the least. During one summer visit, a winter coat and long pants covered as much of Avery's skin as possible, and when Tammy asked why she couldn't sit back in her car seat, Avery replied that if she told them, it would only get worse. Tammy asked if she had a boo-boo, and Avery finally answered,
"Yes, on my back. Mommy whipped my ass with a belt."
At one point during that visit, as Tammy helped Avery straighten out her shirt, the shirt lifted, revealing a gruesome abrasion in the middle of a swollen, painful welt measuring about 4 inches by 1 inch across Avery's lower back. This injury was clearly inflicted by a belt. When the Risens returned Avery home that day, they asked Brittany about it. Secure in her knowledge that they could do absolutely nothing about it, Brittany admitted the wound was inflicted by a belt, and moreover, she had forced Avery to wear the belt all day as a reminder of her supposed bad behavior. After that conversation, Tammy bit the bullet and called the caseworker, Stephanie, regardless of the magistrate's threats of punishment for doing so. Tammy warned Stephanie that if abuse this severe had started already, Brittany would surely cause Avery's death in due time. Stephanie blew off the warning, telling Tammy that she was exaggerating and instructing the concerned grandmother not to contact her anymore. About 4 months after Brittany had regained custody of Avery, the Risens found out that, because Avery was supposedly misbehaving in the care of her mother, Brittany had taken the four-year-old to several doctors until she found one willing to diagnose Avery with bipolar-like symptoms and prescribe her with serious, heavy-duty psychiatric medications. I am the very last person who will ever tell you that a child cannot display symptoms of mental illness or emotional disturbance, even at a very young age. I will, however, argue that these symptoms had to have shown up in one form or another, as early as infancy or at least sometime prior to diagnosis. Avery never displayed a single hint of any type of behavioral problems while living with the Risens, even when she was bounced all over creation for multiple court-ordered overnight visitations per month with other family members. Suddenly, she's in her mother's custody, and she's displaying behavior problems severe enough to warrant drugging her at the age of 4?
Yeah, no.
One day in February of 2016, Avery told Tammy that her mother had forbidden her to use her last name, Hobbs, and that she was only allowed to use the last name, Roll. Avery's last name on her birth certificate was Hobbs, and trying to strip her of her legal name out of pure spite was low even for Brittany. Tammy asked Avery who she wanted to be, and Avery replied,
"I want to be your cupcake, Mama, and I want to be your baby forever."
From then on, Avery was Mama's cupcake, and as always, Pappy's dear. As winter turned into spring, Avery's hair loss grew more and more pronounced. Avery told Tammy that her mother told doctors that Avery hit her head on the walls and pulled out her own hair, but that wasn't true. Brittany was, in fact, pulling Avery's hair and hitting her 4-year-old daughter in the head with a hairbrush in an attempt to hide any resulting bruises. In addition to hair, Avery began losing weight at an alarming rate. By June, the formerly potty-trained little girl started wetting her pants, so she brought a backpack to each visit containing a change of clothes. More concerningly, she seemed extremely drowsy and began passing out at times during her visits to her grandparents. Once when Avery fell asleep, Tammy began rubbing her back and felt something. When she lifted Avery's shirt, Tammy was surprised to find a medical patch, which Brittany dismissed as a new drug she was on. Tammy was certain Avery was overdosing based on her level of sluggishness throughout the entire visit, but when she called guardian ad litem Julie Pedersen after dropping Avery off at her mother's house, she never received as much as a return phone call. During another visit, Tammy had to work, so John brought Avery to the salon to visit with her. While there, they called Jamie's sister Angie so Avery could speak with her cousin and best friend, Lou. I'll quote directly from Tammy's book for this part. Ree is what Tammy called Avery, and I'll insert the party's real names in place of the fake names Tammy used in the book. The excerpt reads,
"The call was your normal girl chat until Ree started telling the most disturbing story I have ever heard. Ree said that Charles and Brittany would make her do push-up stands until she fell and duct-taped her legs and mouth to where she was stuck. They would tape her to the bedpost and at the bottom of the stairs, while only feeding her half of an apple per day. If she misbehaved and tried to stand up, Charles would kick her in the stomach until she crumbled into a ball of pain. Adding that Mommy's tickle thumb was hurting badly, and that was why Ree held her pee until she had accidents. She was too afraid to pull her undies down."
Tammy intervened at that point, ending the girl's phone conversation, which was overheard by a room full of Tammy's co-workers and salon customers. One of Tammy's clients, knowing she was forbidden to call authorities alleging abuse against Brittany, took it upon herself to call the city's Crimes Against Children Unit and the 241 Kids Hotline twice, but she was told with each report that they had no proof to investigate. The child's own words were not enough to trigger an investigation. Even if this was the first time Avery's name had come up in JFS's system, these very specific and detailed claims by a perfectly coherent 4-year-old should set off immediate alarm bells for any human being, let alone a child abuse intake specialist. After this incident, Tammy didn't care what happened to her. She called Avery's guardian ad litem again, Julie Pedersen, and told her what Avery had said. What did Julie do? Did she perform an unscheduled drop-in to catch Brittany off guard, confront her with the allegations, and observe the environment without advance notice? No, of course not. She performed a scheduled welfare check, during which Avery played quietly with Play-Doh while Julie observed her. She didn't bother to do a walkthrough of the house to ensure it was clean and appropriate for a 4-year-old. She didn't look in the fridge or the pantry to make sure there was food in the house for Avery to eat. She didn't even speak with Avery or Brittany alone. She dismissed the allegations based on her observations made during that scheduled visit, and she reported to both Tammy and the courts that Avery was fine. Never mind that the year before, in the Risen's care, Avery weighed a healthy 48 pounds, and that now, in Brittany's custody, she weighed barely 20. Never mind Avery's constant exhaustion, the dark circles around her eyes, her fear of going to the bathroom, her sudden sensitivity to light, and her new habit of eating and drinking anything she could get her hands on as quickly as possible whenever she visited her grandparents. In June of 2016, 24-year-old Brittany Marie Roll married 29-year-old Charles Jr. Mays III, who had been married twice before and had a son with each of his former wives, although he reportedly was not allowed to have contact with either of his two young sons. The reason for that restriction is unclear. Also in June, on one of Avery's last visits with her grandparents, Avery begged her mama to take her to Magistrate Peters so she could come home. Helpless, Tammy told her that the judge wouldn't listen to her until she was a little older, maybe after her fifth birthday, which was coming up in about 2 months. They couldn't have known that Avery wouldn't live to celebrate it.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On Friday, July 29th, 2016, the newly minted Brittany Mays placed a call to 911 that lasted approximately 6 minutes. Very little of that call has been made available to the public.
My daughter was complaining she was hot. So I went to put her in the bed to cool her down, and she stopped breathing. She has no heartbeat.
Do you have any injuries, it looked like? Any
nothing
injuries, ma'am?
Nothing that she didn't go to bed with.
Okay.
Just a couple bruises.
When EMTs responded to the Mays home at 1232 Beach Avenue, they found 4-year-old Avery Lee Hobbs underwater in the bathtub, despite Brittany's claim that she had performed chest compressions and administered rescue breathing. Avery was rushed to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, where doctors discovered she had a catastrophic brain injury. Avery was placed on life support. Several members of Brittany's family milled around the hospital for the next 3 days. What about Avery's paternal side of the family, you might wonder? Why weren't they there? The answer to that question is simple. Because they had no idea their cupcake, their dear, their beloved Ree, was in the hospital at all. No one bothered to call a single member of Jamie's family to let them know. For the entire weekend, Avery's paternal family carried on with life as usual, completely unaware of the devastation that would soon wreak havoc in their lives. Tammy and John even performed a gig on Saturday with their band, Sidetrack. It wasn't until the morning of Monday, August 1st, when a friend of Tammy's made a comment on one of her Facebook posts saying how sorry she was, that Tammy realized something was wrong. Tammy picked up her phone and called the friend, who told her that Avery was in the hospital due to a freak accident, that doctors were checking her for brain activity, and that she might be removed from life support later that day. Tammy and Jamie shared the duties of trying to contact Brittany and Sandra, as well as gathering their family members at the house, including John, who was at work. After countless rebuffed phone calls and attempted visits to the hospital to find out Avery's condition, at last Jamie received a call from Detective Keith Witherell, who told him Avery was in critical condition and under the hospital's protective care. The reason Jamie's family hadn't been able to get answers was because Brittany had led everyone to believe that Charles was Avery's father. Moments after that phone call, Jamie received another call, this one from a social worker. In her book, Tammy described the heartbreaking moment her son relayed the news.
Jamie froze, dropped the phone, and fell to the floor, screaming, "She's dead, Mommy! She's dead!" The stunned and heartbroken family piled into their vehicles and rushed to the hospital, where they were directed to wait in the chapel before being led to the unit where Avery remained. Jamie, Tammy, John, and Tim, Jamie's father, entered Avery's hospital room. Again, I'll quote from Tammy's book because her firsthand, visceral descriptions of these terrible moments cannot be outdone.
With that, the nurse slowly pulled the curtain back, and there laid our quiet angel. We took a step back and gasped. We did not recognize the child that laid before us. It was a sleeping child, or appeared to be, but I didn't see Myrie. Our baby was fragile and thin. This child was plump, and someone cut her hair off in chunks down to the flesh. Her head was the size of a basketball. Devices all over and a breathing tube hanging from her drawn lips. That was not Ree. That was not the baby I raised. The nurse didn't want to give us too much information, but she told us that Ree's hair was like that when she came into the hospital, and that she swelled due to injury and blood pooling from those injuries. A blanket covered Ree's body, and her eyes were slightly open. Blood was drying in her tube and running from her ears. I looked into her eyes, but nothing was there.
The family filed in, one by one, to kiss Avery goodbye. When it was Tammy's turn, she wrote,
I bent down and pressed my lips against her skin, flesh that still had warmth from a life she once had. As I did, I told her she would always be Mama's baby, and I was so sorry that I failed her. So damn sorry.
After Avery's death, Jamie's family met with detectives who expressed suspicion of Brittany's account of Avery's so-called freak accident. Investigators informed them that prior to calling 911, Brittany first spent 6 minutes on the phone with Charles. After their interview with detectives, the family visited the funeral home where they somberly arranged a beautiful funeral for a 4-year-old. Jamie's sister Angie, Avery's Gigi, somehow managed to collect Avery's hair to have it sewn back onto the little girl's head. Tammy and John spoke with TV reporters the day after Avery's death. They told WCPO,
We fought as hard as we could to keep her safe.
It's such a shame that a little girl like her couldn't grow up to be a beautiful woman.
I don't understand our laws. I don't understand our systems. This could have been stopped. This could have been prevented if people would have listened.
When they spoke with Local 12, they said,
She was extremely bubbly, always interested in doing things, very interested in music.
Her eyes were swollen shut. She had a neck brace on, and they had all kinds of stuff around her mouth. You couldn't see her mouth. The doctor said that she had head trauma, which caused a brain bleed, and the brain bleed was severe enough that it caused her heart to stop.
And in court, all I heard was in the best interest of the child. That's what Job and Family Services kept saying in court. This is what's in the best interest of the child. And I want them to know that my little child that I raised here is dead. Is that what's in the best interest of a child?
After their media appearances, the family found out that after Brittany's official reunification with her daughter, Avery had been removed from her custody twice with no notice to the family, even though such notification had been court-ordered at the time of the custody ruling. At the time of these removals, Avery was once again under the supervision of Stephanie from JFS and Julie Pedersen. Against the judge's orders, neither they nor Stephanie's supervisor informed Tammy, John, Tim, or Jamie of Avery's intake back into the system. An autopsy performed at the Hamilton County Coroner's Office revealed an unbelievable number of injuries. Avery's tiny, battered body told the story in no uncertain terms of the prolonged abuse she had suffered, all of which had been reported time and time again to JFS, to the court, and to authorities to no avail. The medical examiner reported that Avery had endured the following: bruises and abrasions on virtually every part of her body, vaginal injuries, abdominal injuries, multiple hemorrhages in the brain, multiple hemorrhages in both eyes and both optic nerves, and many, many more. All of these injuries were in various stages of healing, indicating long-term abuse, both physical and sexual. In addition to these findings, the coroner also noted that Avery's hair had been removed, that there was no food present in her stomach, suggesting starvation, and that all drug tests came back negative, which meant Avery had no illegal or prescription medications in her system at the time of her death. What happened to all those behavioral medications that were so necessary for this 4-year-old to function, according to Brittany and her cronies? The drug results would also negate a later claim Brittany made that Charles had drugged and assaulted her daughter. She'd throw anyone under the bus if it meant saving her own ass. Avery's death was ruled a homicide due to blunt force trauma to the head. Jamie and his family, finding out that Brittany was attempting to take custody of Avery's remains with the intention of having them cremated, had a temporary hold placed on Avery's body to prevent Brittany from following through with the cremation while she was under investigation. Can you imagine anything shadier than this woman hoping to destroy evidence by cremating the daughter she just beat to death? Honestly, Brittany's obviously very cunning and manipulative, but she's also, in many ways, dumb as a box of rocks.
Bruh.
Fortunately, detectives realized this, and on August 10, 2016, Brittany Marie Mays was arrested and booked into Hamilton County Jail on 1 count of aggravated murder, 2 counts of murder, and 1 count of child endangerment. Her husband Charles was off the hook due to insufficient evidence and Brittany's admission that she was alone with Avery at the time of her daughter's fatal injuries. At a bond hearing the following day, Brittany's defense attorney, Bradley Fox, told the court,
Your Honor, as to bond, she is a Hamilton County resident, married. Her husband, Charles Mays, lives in Hamilton County. They've been married for 2 months. She does work full-time for the past 2.5 years at Home Depot on Glenway.
Assistant Prosecutor David Wood said,
The defendant is accused of causing the death of the victim, who is her own 4-year-old daughter, by committing a felonious assault against that child using blunt force trauma to inflict a head injury. That head injury was serious enough to cause the child's death. It's particularly concerning, Judge Berkowitz, because this defendant was previously convicted of fracturing that child's skull in a charge in front of Judge Ruhlman for child endangering. She pled guilty to an attempt back in 2011, was sentenced to 6 months in prison. One more thing that is particularly concerning is that my indication from the arrest report is that the defendant is 7 months pregnant.
Judge Josh Berkowitz was having none of Brittany's shenanigans.
Allegations here are beyond comprehension. And given the history, I think a very high bond is clearly appropriate. Bond will be set on the murder charge of $2 million secured.
Brittany was indicted on August 17th and arraigned on August 18th at a hearing overseen by Judge Robert Ruhlman, the same judge who had told Brittany 4 years prior that he never wanted to see her in his courtroom again. Clearly fed up with the unrepentant psychopath, Judge Ruhlman revoked Brittany's $2 million bond, ordering her held without bond, and ruled that she could not have contact with her child after it was born. By the time Avery's remains were ultimately released by the coroner's office, it had been almost 3 weeks since her death, and sadly, the family was unable to say goodbye to their little girl in an open casket. On August 19, 2016, Avery Lee Delia Hobbs was buried, wearing her princess dress and the little sandals she called flip-flabs. Her beautiful dark brown hair was sewn onto her head, and she held a blanket emblazoned with characters from the Disney movie Frozen, as well as one of the stuffed bunnies her mother had thrown away. Her hands bore the stick figure drawing Tammy had created long ago, which Brittany could never again wash off. As her casket was lowered into the earth, Jamie placed Avery's giant daddy bear on top to protect his little girl for eternity. In the months following Avery's death, a memorial bench was placed at Mitchell Memorial Forest in Green Township, Ohio, otherwise known as Avery's favorite Green Park. A plaque on the bench reads, Avery Cupcake Hobbs. You'll be with us always. Daddy, Pappy and Mama, Papa, Nana, Gigi, and Tot. From time to time, the family leaves large Ziploc bags full of stuffed bunnies on the bench, with a note for other children to take one as a gift from Avery.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
For the 3 years following Britney's arrest, she and her attorneys requested continuances at least 25 times, according to court records. In the meantime, in July of 2019, Jamie spoke with Fox 19. He said of Avery,
"She was just an amazing child. Just walk into a room and everybody's happy."
About his ex-wife, Britney, Jamie said,
"I'd want her to sit in prison for the rest of her life and think about what she did."
He said of the long wait for justice,
"You get that feeling that something good is finally going to come out of it, and then 3 years later, you're still waiting, and nothing's happened. I mean, it's tearing my family apart. It's tearing our friends apart."
Jamie also spoke with Local 12 reporter Dwayne Pullman in 2019 as part of Dwayne's series entitled Failure to Protect Avery. When Dwayne asked if he still spoke to Avery, Jamie said that he did every day and broke down when Dwayne asked what he said to her.
"Tell her, sorry. That I couldn't help her. I love her. I miss her."
Dwayne released the first two of three planned pieces in his excellent investigative series in November of 2019 and still plans to release a third. In October of 2020, Dwayne won a well-deserved Emmy for Best Investigative Report for his Failure to Protect Avery series. Britney's trial was scheduled to begin on January 13, 2020. And Jamie's side of the family arrived at the courthouse that morning, ready for jury selection to begin. Instead, the prosecutor took them into a room and told them that at the last minute, Britney had accepted a plea agreement sparing her the possibility of the death penalty. Instead of the trial they had anticipated, they were then led into the courtroom to watch Britney's sentencing hearing unfold. During the hearing, Britney gave a brief statement. "When I recorded the clip, I titled this file, Least Authentic Apology Ever.
It really wasn't what it seemed. I really did love my daughter. I love all my kids. And I'm sorry."
I've watched that clip over and over, and there is not a single sparkle of moisture in that woman's eyes, let alone tears falling during that pathetic performance. Judge Robert Ruhlman accepted Britney's guilty plea to the charge of aggravated murder, dismissed her charge of child endangerment and her two counts of murder, and sentenced her to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. Given the facts of the case, Judge Ruhlman said he was skeptical the parole board would ever release her, and even told Britney,
"I hope they never let you out. Ever."
"Although you're the one that did this, killed her, you're responsible for it. The system is also involved in this thing, and the system really let that child down, did not protect that child at all."
"Over in the juvenile court, they have this presumption of trying to reunify children with their biological parents. And I think what they have to recognize is sometimes that's not the best thing to do. Here, clearly it was not."
After the hearing, Tammy told a Local 12 reporter,
"Did we want to take 20 years to life? No, we wanted to see much more than that. But that's a way to give us all a little resolution today and something I think we can all live with and move on from."
About her little cupcake, Tammy said,
"She had a lot of people that loved her, that would have done anything to protect her. And she was intelligent. She could talk by 1 year old. She told on her mother everything that her mother did, and nobody would listen."
"We have to change things to protect children. Avery was a wonderful child."
Tammy was unable to read her victim impact statement at the hearing, but I'm going to read it for you now in its entirety because it deserves to be heard.
"Your Honor, I am Avery's biological paternal grandmother and was her designated care provider since the age of less than 1 month to almost 4 years. Brittany, I wish you to look at me. When you came into my life, I gave you a home and a mother's care. I offered you guidance and discipline. Then you rejected my attention due to resentment. I was the person you despised the most because I was a mother figure that did not believe in you as I knew what you were. That became a problem in our relationship, and you gave me no choice but to fight against you. After you, and you alone, abandoned and injured both of your children, I took them both under my care. Where your mother later took one, I raised the other from birth. You made the disgust you had towards me and placed it on your child, because I valued her more than I ever did you, Brittany. You never realized it was because she was so helpless against your violence. You took everything Avery loved away from her. You tried to destroy her beauty. While you indeed took her life, you can never remove her spirit, nor the admiration she and I had for one another, the same love I offered you. The shame is that you destroyed Avery with your commissioned confidants. A social worker, guardians, and therapists who all aided you over your child based on your lies and venom. With that in mind, I do not have much to say to you, as you are now entirely irrelevant. However, I do want to leave an image you can think about for the rest of your life. We buried Avery as Avery Lee Cupcake Hobbs. In her princess dress, we did so in flip-flops, frozen blanket, and her natural hair sewn back upon her head. She's holding her bunny you threw away from the daycare, and she has all others left in my home. She lays with her daddy bear and every toy you thought you removed, and most significantly, she has a signet of 3 stick figures on her hands. All of us departing from her laid our last kiss upon her that you never will remove. Jamie is her custodian for eternity, and he is her father that you destroyed from criminal actions you committed. Yet he remains her cherished father, and you nothing more than her killer. Now I will speak to the court. Today I plead for Brittany's sentencing, since I can no longer beg for a child's life. I want to remind everyone that I raised Avery unscathed her entire time that she spent in my care, unlike when in her mother's. Brittany took every opportunity to harm her child throughout her life under the supervision of CPS and a guardian. They excused Brittany's actions and never protected Avery. A therapist unlawfully diagnosed me in a successful effort that depleted my chance at Avery's custody. All individuals were vile and placed Avery in grave danger, knowingly and willingly. Brittany escaped criminal charges when she hospitalized her first child through the aid of CPS. She also escaped higher criminal charges when she fractured Avery's skull, serving a mere 6-month sentence. Brittany escaped abuse charges after years of monumental accounts of attacks against Avery. She managed to regain custody of Avery twice in 1 year with exact bodily harm matching all the allegations I reported. Brittany managed this with the aid of CPS, guardians, and a therapist. Both of those removals contained founded repetitive abuse, yet social services validated all Brittany's actions and blamed the child, proposing the child deserved to be beaten. They all went on to over-medicate the child or correct the mother with the guardian as the lead source. Brittany has 2 deceased children and 1 that recovered her abuse. My question is, when will it stop? Everyone in the past covered Brittany's constant reoccurring crimes. Everyone gave her an overabundant amount of chances that were unwarranted, neglectful, endangering, and unjustified. Brittany squandered every one of those opportunities by harming her children, and 1 to death. CPS claimed the years they spent reprogramming Brittany led her to be a safe candidate to care for her child. That was not true. That was the fabricated jargon of inept people who choose an abusive adult over a defenseless child. All this should make it logically assumptive that Brittany will never change. Not then, and not now. Avery had only 1 chance in life. 1. That chance is when she was in my home. Avery had stability, education, nurturing care, and a home filled with love. She had a real chance at a great life, but that was taken away repetitively by people paid to protect her via parental rights and their sickening agenda. Those rights and the people backing those rights are the direct cause of Avery's murder. Brittany may have taken Avery's last breath, but CPS and all its affiliates gave Brittany the ammo. I want to remind this court that Avery was starved, drugged, mentally beat down, physically tortured, and sexually assaulted until she ultimately died. In another bathtub from another blunt force to her skull. Her demise came after countless attempts to save her life by reporting these occurrences of heinous ill will, while nobody but our family attempted to save her. Avery's welfare was ignored by those this state placed in her protection, and on 2 occasions putting her back with Brittany after medical, physical, visual, and witnessed evidence radically appeared and vanished. Avery was the victim. Brittany was not the victim. CPS treated and presented Brittany like one, but she was Avery's abuser. Avery had no right to speak or to be taken seriously after she, at such a young age, begged a social worker to remove her from Brittany. Instead, that social worker called her a liar. Avery had no deal, no second chance. Her little, tiny body that was dissected and left rotting for 19 days was because of parental rights. We could not even bury Avery as the princess she was. This poor child, whose death was preventable, lies in a cold, damp grave. Avery was too decomposed to see her one last time, and too rotted to kiss goodbye. It is a nightmare we all live with, seeing such a promising life desecrated as she was when she should be playing, growing, and becoming the woman we all knew she would be. With that in mind, I ask, how many chances did Brittany give her child? How many days, hours, or minutes did Brittany permit Avery to have between beatings? How many nights did Brittany allow Avery to sleep without her hands in her virginal cavities? How many? How much sympathy do you think Brittany had towards her child? How much? I can imagine there is none to find. It is why I beg of the courts to bestow the same upon Brittany. This mother gave no mercy to her child, and we should only provide her with the same. No more deals, no more chances, and certainly no more mercy. Brittany needs to face what she has done. Brittany needs not to be cowardly, as she was not a coward the night she took Avery's life. For that, I believe that the death penalty is the only justice for the ongoing severe abuse that caused Avery's murder by the hand of the person that should have loved her the most, her mother. Avery lies in a box that her mother built 24 hours per day. Brittany should lie in a box that justice made until her death. Anything less would be inappropriate, because we are all in prison and we're never getting out.
Avery's family may not have gotten the justice they deserved with Brittany's sentence, but at least some form of justice has been done. After I released episode 47, a lot of people asked me what happened to the other people responsible for Avery's death. Well, apparently Charles Mays III has custody of the son he shares with a murderer. He seems to be a difficult man to find these days, and I can understand why. He was never charged in connection with Avery's abuse or death, although Avery's words against him are pretty damning.
Other than my mom.
What do they do?
Whip me.
Whip you?
And put me in the corner. And I want to sit down in it. They told me, no, stand up. And Charles kicked me down. And I wanted to go to the bathroom, and he kicked me down.
Did he hurt you when he kicked you down?
Yes. That hurt.
I hope his son is well and protected. As for those paid to protect Avery, according to Tammy, one was demoted, one saw her pay decreased and subsequently resigned, and another is working as a divorce attorney. I was able to track down the whereabouts of guardian ad litem Julie Pedersen, who is, hilariously, working as an assistant to the public defender in traffic court in another Ohio county. It's not enough, of course. That's not justice. The number of people who failed Avery Lee Hobbs is stunning. Let's see. We have the Hamilton County Department of Jobs and Family Services, caseworker Stephanie and her supervisor in particular, therapist Suzanne, guardian ad litem Julie, Magistrate Peters for giving Brittany custody, Judge John Williams for upholding that ruling, and finally, Avery's own birth organism, Brittany Marie Roll Mays, who is now moldering away in the Marysville, Ohio Prison for Women, where she recently celebrated her 29th birthday. Brittany could be paroled as early as August 5th, 2036, which is so far beyond ridiculous I can barely stand to contemplate it. About 2 weeks after her conviction, she filed an appeal, for which there hasn't yet been a decision, but I'll keep an eye on that and post any updates on sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. The last hearing on that was January 21st. Brittany is the single most manipulative person I think I've ever covered, maybe even worse than Elisa Fairchild, Zara Baker's stepmother, who's a demon spawn in her own right. People like Brittany are the reason I feel so strongly that our children need education, at least in high school, if not earlier, about relationship red flags, the warning signs of a narcissistic partner, and other domestic abuse-related topics. Jamie was young and vulnerable when he met Brittany, and she was able to take over his life and all but destroy it. I sincerely hope he's able to overcome the trauma she's caused him. As for Tammy, the granny with a mission, she has worked tirelessly to keep Avery's memory alive and to push for necessary changes in the systems that failed her granddaughter. She released her book, In the Best Interest of a Child, in 2020, a no-holds-barred, tell-all account of Avery's story, which I strongly recommend reading. Again, it's available for Kindle, and I'll link to the book page on Amazon in the show notes for anyone interested. Tammy has created a concept she calls DEAR, which stands for Developing Essential Advocate Restoration for Abused Children. I'll link to the Facebook page in the show notes as well. She describes DEAR as
a futuristic concept to promote law change and other avenues that would be of aid to abused children and their care providers.
Tammy has also worked for years on a legislation change to protect children like Avery, and on January 14, 2021, she submitted for consideration the Avery Statute. Boiled down to its simplest explanation, the statute aims to prohibit child abuse victims from being reunified with their convicted abusers, as well as necessitating periodic medical assessments in cases where reunification is sought, and providing placement parents or guardians with the authorization to have a child medically evaluated if abuse is suspected. I highly recommend checking out the Justice for Avery website for a lot more information and specifics, and I'll link to the website in the show notes as well. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Tammy Risen, who is now one of my personal heroes. Today I'm speaking with Tammy Risen, who is the grandmother of Avery. Hi, Tammy. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hello.
Your story is the most egregious that I've ever heard in terms of CPS failure, and I've heard a lot of them, but I continue to be shocked by everything that keeps coming up. I can't even put it into words how much they failed this poor little girl.
And it was constantly. The big thing was that they weren't even actively involved until she was about 14 months old. She was just placed with me. And during that time period, everything was good. She was healthy and everything was going along. They were very agreeable with me. But when the mother was released from prison that first time and started to interact with the child, that's when everything turned.
So when Avery was about 14 months old, that's when Brittany was convicted of injuring her in the bathtub the first time?
Right. They actually wanted to charge her with a higher crime, and they let my son decide what charge to go with. The initial charge, she would have been imprisoned quite a long time. I can't remember the exact charge, but it carried quite a sentence. And he was unsure at that moment if it was an accident or not. Mm-hmm. So he chose the lesser crime and they agreed, and that's what they charged her with. And then they pled that down to even a lesser crime. And that was only a 6-month sentence.
I guess it would probably be important just for context. And also, I just feel very strongly that it's important to point out to people some of the red flags. It seems to me that Brittany had some type of personality disorder. And I know you had mentioned that in the book, that it's a possibility. Was she ever diagnosed with anything?
Yes, during the actual custody trial, we were trying to get someone to diagnose her, and the judge did agree to that. So they had her tested, but it was always through an affiliate. So they came along that she had a personality disorder, but they also said that that disorder would not prohibit her from being a good mother. And of course, after she killed her, then that personality disorder was used as a cover. And you can't have it both ways.
Right, exactly. It's either going to affect everything or it's not. It didn't seem like they diagnosed her correctly. Like you had said, she definitely showed signs of antisocial behavior and narcissistic behavior at the minimum, if not, you know, others as well. She was a nightmare. How old was Jamie when he met Brittany?
He was just turning 18, and she was violent from the get-go.
That was the way it started. It was 0 to 60 with her.
Right. Or we realized she was violent from the beginning. But I heard stories through her family and herself about her violent tendencies since she was very little, like 2 years old. So this was highly instilled in her, but yet nobody wanted to recognize it.
And then she did injure Jamie, but she didn't end up in jail for that one.
No, he protected her at all costs. And he didn't want to be known as a man that was beaten by his wife. And he always covered it up. And he just now, over these past few years, he started to tell the truth, because I had to interview him to get a good sense of his side of things. And I've been hearing things I didn't even know.
And of course, that's kind of a stigma, too, is the man who doesn't want to be known as being beaten up by a woman. That was the part that initially made me just gasp out loud reading this book, talking about how she grabbed a paperweight and smashed it against his skull.
Yes, that was at my dinner table with my family around the table. She was going to do it again if she was not stopped. Yeah.
Was she just in a blind rage, or was it a calculated move, do you think?
I don't know, because before she would strike, she would compose herself. So you never knew when it was coming. It just
just came. But that particular time, she would walk and huff around my living room. And then she just walked over nonchalant, grabbed that up, and whammed him against the head.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's very lucky that the injury wasn't worse. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, there was many injuries to him and many, many witnesses that seen it, family and not family.
Pretty incredible that after all of that and everything that was witnessed, that CPS and the court system wouldn't at least recognize that she had the capacity to do harm. But the way CPS protected her is just obscene in that light.
Right. They had her as a victim.
Right.
And she's the only one they categorized as a victim. They never said that Avery was a victim, just the mother. And that's who they chose to protect at all costs. They would protect that mother. And that's an ongoing trend, not just with Avery's story, but with many children's story.
So she just had them wrapped right around her finger.
They could even see it visually. They visually seen it and did nothing.
And that's all the bruises and the sunburns that Avery had to submit to. And
right. And when she got older, Avery was highly intelligent and she could talk to you just as I am now. And when she was 3 years old, we were in the therapist's office and she asked me, "Is it okay, Mama, if I tell?" And I said, "Yes," because I knew kind of what she was referring to. Mm-hmm. And she told her mother in front of the therapist for the mother to stop touching her vagina because it hurt and it was gross. And even with that display of her attempting to protect herself, the therapist just looks at me and says, "Well, you know, the mother has all the rights. She can do what she wants." And I was flabbergasted. I was just floored that at that moment, they would still choose to protect this mother.
It's beyond comprehension. I think to anyone who has not had any dealings with the system, we are built to think that CPS is there to protect the child. But it doesn't seem to be the case in far too many stories.
Yes, because a lot of times the way they would twist it around to the judge was that I was either crazy or I was trying to make all these things up and I was coaching Avery to say these things. And they would say they themselves never seen a problem. And I don't know how you can lie in court when you just seen a child bruised head to toe telling you what her mother's doing and then go lie to a judge and say, "There's no problem here."
No, it's just the mother cleaning her up after she uses the bathroom or, you know.
Right. That's what she said. Yeah. But it was found in the autopsy the same, except for at that point, the injuries got more severe. And I think because I had a great sense of who she was the moment I laid my eyes on her. And I really think that she hated my son. She hated me. And I think somewhere in the back of her mind, she thought, "Well, you know, I'm hurting them by hurting this child."
Yeah, that seems to be a common thread. It's pretty awful that someone can look at their own offspring and only see the other parent and want to harm it.
Yes. And she was very vain. She was very vain about her looks and her appearance. And her daughter was 10 times more attractive than she. And I don't believe she liked that either.
Her little voice on those recordings, I had tears in my eyes hearing her cry that she didn't want to go. That's just so awful and sad. And again, it's something that happens in so many of these cases, but it's not heard by anyone who can make a difference until it's too late.
No, that's why I chose to do all the things I've done and all the things I'm trying to do. So we don't have to hear another child do this, but we'll see how far I can go with that.
It's admirable that you're pushing this hard just to make Avery's story known. And then the law that you're looking to change. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, too? Because I think that's really important.
Yes, because I've changed it many, many times because I have presented it to one of the House of Representatives, and I'll leave his name unknown. But there's certain language that they couldn't get through even with a legal team working on it. So I've adjusted that, and I finally came down to what I'm calling the Avery statute, and it's comprised of three parts. It's not exactly what I wanted, but it would be a great start. And the one section of it would be the leader of that law, because not only would it protect a child, but it would protect the parents and it would protect social workers. It'd be full scale protection to all of them. I'm trying to get the states to add a tag of a circumstance to a crime when committed against a child under the age of 13 that was either felonious in nature or a crime that has been secondary to one previous. And if they would put that tag on that charge, then Child Protection Services could not reunite that child to that parent.
That
would void their parental rights right there. So nobody could get that child back to that parent because the injury that caused them to have that charge in the first place was so substantial, that person should never have the right to have that child again.
For example, Brittany causing that skull fracture too. How old was Avery at the time? Only a few months, right?
She was 3.5 weeks old. And what they fudged up in her medical records, because I was there, she had an arm and leg fracture. And somehow, all those records from 2011, you can't find them.
Really?
It was put on her record in 2012 when they were trying to say that he was the culprit. So if you look at her medical records, the arm and leg fracture is not even noted until the following year. So I don't know how the records got tainted like that.
Right, because they were, in 2012, it was mentioned that they were healing or healed wounds. Is that right?
They were closed fractures, yes. And when I talked to the doctor, they said they were old. And I'm like, yes, they're old. They're a year old.
Okay, so that was kind of where they started snowballing Jamie's supposed involvement in the injuries.
Yes.
But she continued to be injured even when they stopped allowing him to be a part of her life for a time period there.
From that point forth, he was not allowed to see her.
And yet she continued to turn up with all of the different bruises and even the burn marks. Having those explained away as bug bites that just made my head want to explode.
And the bite marks, the ones I could get good pictures of was the ones that was on her feet.
Yes.
But they were on her inner thigh. They were on her breast. The social worker said, oh, they were just playing.
That's amazing.
Yes.
And they were adult-sized teeth, but they blamed it on her sister, who was only a couple years older than her.
2 years older. Well, no, a year older.
Okay.
She was born in 10. Yeah.
Now her sister, is she now in the custody of her family, her father?
Yes. And I always wanted to protect her and I wanted to protect them. I didn't want anybody to know their name or to cause them any grief. So, and she's just a little child. But yeah, she is taken care of. Thank God.
That's wonderful. Was Brittany, did she have a third child as well? She had one later on, right?
She had a total of 4.
Oh, okay.
She had the first one and she was abusive towards her. Then Avery, then I had her. Then in 2015, she got, I think she was like 7 or 8 months pregnant and nobody knows what happened to that baby. Not her family, not detectives. Nobody could find out what happened to that child. And then she had the fourth one in prison.
She has destroyed a lot of people's lives, I would imagine, and a lot of trust. I mean, especially in a system like CPS, this whole situation must just blow a lot of minds.
You would think that Avery's case would wake up Child Protection Services. You would think they would change something, and they don't. They're continuing to make the same mistakes. And I have people reaching out to me, telling me their stories, and I cannot believe that they haven't changed enough to help kids, especially since Avery's case was so big. I mean, there were so many people fighting, telling them that this isn't right. This child's abused. There were so many family members in that courtroom going against Child Protection Services. When they would interview Avery, the social worker, and they did that in my house, and they did this at this therapist's office. When Avery tried to tell them, she did a really good job for her age. You know, she showed no fear. She told them point blank. And then you have a social worker tell a little baby that she's a liar. Do you know what a liar is? And they were trying to coach her to say that she lied.
It's crazy how they took Brittany's side and stayed squarely in her corner no matter what evidence came up against her. It's
no matter what. When they took her away for the second time, because she only had her a few months before they took her away again. And all those injuries exactly mimicked everything that all our people told them. And if he had a doctor backing up the diagnosis that this baby was being abused. And they were supposed to tell us, they were supposed to tell all the petitioners, if custody changed hands because of this case being so overwhelming, we were supposed to be notified. And they all lied to us. They lied to all the petitioners because that was our chance to go back in and get emergency custody from the judge. But they lied. We never knew. She was sent to a daycare worker by the social worker. we had to go all over the place picking her up, and nobody would tell us why or what was going on and why wasn't she with her mother. And she finally was given back again. But during that span, the child had no injuries, not until she went back to her mother again.
And how long was she back with Brittany before she was actually killed?
It was either very late December or early January of 16. Okay. So 6 months.
Okay.
And it wasn't but about 3 months in that Avery started to show substantial abuse. We had a child that couldn't be in sunlight, didn't have energy to move from her position. If you touched her, she would crouch down. She wanted to go to the bathroom because she was afraid to pull down her panties. All her hair was being torn out. She was overdosed. And she wore winter clothing in 95 degrees. And if you dare try to take off a jacket or anything to cool her off, she'd tell you, no, I'll get in trouble.
And she had lost quite a bit of weight.
About half her weight.
Oh, that is awful. So does it seem like Brittany was punishing her by withholding food?
She told us that her mom would give her half an apple a day. The judge has threatened me before that if I rose one eyebrow of abuse in his courtroom, he would either fine me or put me in prison. So I called him directly. And it's like, if you're going to put me in prison, here I am. But I got to let you know what's going on. So he did promise to put this guardian ad litem back on the case. And they put another safety measure on Avery. And they were supposed to keep that on another year. And I finally got to talk to this guardian ad litem. And she went for a visit and she texted me. She didn't even have the nerve to call me. She put this in text message where you could keep it as evidence. And she said everything looked fine. Avery looked fine. She was playing with Play-Doh. And I responded that the child's overdosed. We couldn't wake her up. She's telling us these horrendous stories of this torture, you know, water torture, made to run in place until she fell, push-up stands until she fell. And if she tried to get up, she would get kicked in the stomach by the stepfather. You know, all these horrific things she was telling us, and I'm trying to put this in a text message. And the only thing I got back as a reply is, I'll teach the mother how to drug her. And I'm like, where did you get your medical license?
Right.
They would not allow me to take her to a doctor, not even when I had the guardianship.
Every time she had an injury, you couldn't do anything about it until at one point your husband just got sick of the, was it the sunburn?
She had an inner ear infection.
Right. Okay.
Right. When she was just crying nonstop. Nobody would respond to us if we could take her to a doctor, and he did it. He was like, hell with it. Whatever they're going to do to us, but we got to get this baby out of pain. But anytime we had injuries of abuse, they would tell us, no, you can't take her to a doctor, or the mom would have to be there to stare her down in fear, or the social worker would come to my house, see it, and discard it as bug bites or whatever, and wouldn't let me take her.
That's awful. And yep. So when she did end up at the doctor, she had to go in for surgery to get tubes in your ears because she had such a severe infection. Is that?
Yes. It had went on so long without me being able to help her. And at one time I did get medicine for it. But that was during a visitation to the mother, and she wouldn't give her the medicine.
She just enjoyed watching her daughter in pain. It doesn't make any sense to a normal person, but.
Yeah. And, you know, I contacted anybody you can think that you're supposed to contact, you know, Child Protection Services, the guardian ad litem, the courts, the police, any avenue that you think is a human being that you should do to help protect a child. We did. But they kept telling us that we lied, even though they had a child there with everything on her body that exactly mimicked what we were telling them. And they never justified how she got abused.
Right. They only came up with strange excuses. Some of them were very weird. I mean, just the playing doctor to explain the bite marks. Doctors don't bite. I mean, what is that supposed to mean? A lot of it was just very flimsy. They documented the same excuses in the file, right? They actually...
A lot of the times, yes. Yes, they documented their excuses. But they also eliminated a lot of it. The only thing they wanted to make sure that was in their records was that, like I said, that I was this overbearing grandmother that wanted this child because I couldn't conceive my own, even though I had two adult children. And that I hated the mother and I wanted to steal this child away from the mother and I was just doing everything I could to cause this mother problems. And it's like, you came up with this cockamamie story, but then you have a therapist back it up with a diagnosis of me that I was never involved with.
This therapist who was court appointed, right?
Yes.
She somehow managed to work up a psychological diagnosis of you just from the family meetings?
Yes, without me knowing that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what did she end up coming out with, and how did that work against you?
I don't know exactly what it said because they want to show me. They showed me. It was like a booklet that they submitted against me to the appeals judge that I was unstable. You know, every time I got into those meetings, I did everything I could to make them understand why they were wrong. And because they kept pushing my buttons to where I was aggravated, it was like hitting your head against a wall.
Yeah.
And it's like, what part of this don't you get? But anyway, by me reacting, they said I was just about crazy.
And so all you were doing was just pushing back against the claims they were making. They used you protecting your granddaughter as evidence that you
had an elevated voice. You know, in those meetings, I had quite an elevated voice. And at one time during the meeting, I just turned to the mother and I just stared her down. I'm like, you are abusing your child. You are putting your hands on her. And I don't know what these people don't get, but it's got to stop. And, you know, that's how I did it, but maybe with a more elevated tone. But that's basically what I said. And I was problematic by trying to do their job, which is to protect a child.
I just can't imagine how frustrating that must be. Just knowing that you were trying to protect Avery from harm or from what you must have seen as inevitable at some point.
I knew it.
Yeah.
I knew she was going to get killed. I told him that she was going to get killed, you know, both at the custody trial and on the appeals. On the appeals directly, I had a whole bunch of them in the elevator with me. And I pointed in their face and I said, I want you all to remember this. I give her a year before she kills her. In the custody, I pointed to the lady typing everything in. And I said, you all just killed this child. So they knew my position. That I knew without a shadow of a doubt that she was going to kill her. It was a matter of when.
It's a circumstance where you hate to be right. It happens so often that it's so predictable. And, you know, anyone with a reasonable mind can see it coming miles away. But everyone who's up close and supposed to be doing their jobs ignores the signs until it's far too late.
Yes. And I don't understand Child Protection Services' position. I know their job is to reunite children back to their family under certain circumstances. But when things become this out of tune with all these allegations of abuse that's apparent, that could be substantiated, that they still choose to stay with the reunification to the one that abused them. Mm-hmm. You would think that at that point they would say, hey, judge, no, we're seeing things that are concerning here. But at no time did they ever turn their backs on Brittany.
The fact that they are constantly pushing for reunification has been the cause, the catalyst for so many children who end up on my blog, on my podcast. It's so frustrating. Yeah. I don't understand that point of view from them, where they seem to think that without fail, the biological mother is where the child belongs, when that is not always the environment that the child needs to be in. And especially when there's other family members more than willing and fighting to have this child in their homes. And in your case, there were three sets of grandparents petitioning for custody?
There was actually four in the beginning, yeah. Plus the father. My son was fighting too. But, you know, they do this and they know there's no repercussions if they're wrong. There's no repercussions if the child ends up dead because of the immunity laws. It's this big umbrella that protects them no matter what. And seemingly, a social worker's power is more powerful than a judge.
That part really stunned me, where Jamie was given at least visitation at one point, and as soon as he walked out of the courtroom, the social worker stopped him and said, over my dead body, basically.
Yes, that was at Christmas. The judge said, yeah, you know, we've gone this long, you know, there's been no harm to Avery, and he did award him visitation, and it was documented. And as soon as we walked out of the courtroom, that social worker went right up to him and said, nope, I don't care what the judge says. You're going to do this if you're going to see her at all. And that's when we went downtown for the visit. And, you know, we had to drag all the presents, everything downtown to child protection. And what does the social worker do? She gets up and leaves and she lets me watch him. And it's like, I could have done this at home.
And that's after she's told you that, no, we can't do it at your house because I need to be present.
Right, because they didn't think I was capable of protecting her from the demon, my son. Yet we all go downtown and she leaves me to do the monitoring. So she just did that to prove that she was in charge and that she was more powerful than the judge.
And that's pretty scary. It really shouldn't be that way, obviously, but it seems, especially in some jurisdictions, maybe the judges defer a little bit too much to the social workers. And that particular woman sounds like a nightmare on legs. It was a power trip for her from day one.
Yes, it was. And she always wanted to prove her weight. And then because we have this immunity law that protects these people and they know it, you know, how could I build a petition for law that wouldn't do nothing? Because as long as we have that in place, which is unchangeable, it has been for a century, what can we do? Well, the only thing I could think to do is once they're in that system, we can't protect them because it's going to be the same story over and over again. But if we can stop these kids from getting in that system, stop them from getting reunited back to an abusive parent that's on that level of abuse, then that's the only thing I think that we can do to save them.
It must be different in each state as far as the immunity law, because I know in some cases, the CPS workers can and have been sued or at least held liable, but it's definitely not in all states. I know some, they don't face any consequences whatsoever. So
It's sovereign immunity. And I can't think of the other one, but it basically means that the king can do no wrong. They were more responsible than the mother. And I'm saying that I'm not trying to justify the mother, but I kind of say it as this. A dog is a dog. You can't change a dog. This mother was evil. You cannot change the fact that she was evil. Everybody knew it. Everybody knew she was abusing the child. To me, that makes them more responsible than the killer. They were the ammunition in her weapon.
It's a great way to put it, and it's just an awful fact. She's certainly where she belongs. Now, she was sentenced to life.
20 years to life. And she is now, well, she was put in prison in 16. So she's going towards the 5-year mark. So she's got about 15 years to go before I have to take this great fight to keep her in prison.
Absolutely. I'm sure you'll be at every hearing, and not to mention, you know, the other surviving grandparents. Is mother still alive?
Brittany's mother is alive, but as soon as she killed her child, that grandparent has not been seen or heard from again. But of course, that's the same woman that went into the custody trial saying, yeah, her daughter was the best thing since sliced bread. She's not a danger. She's a great mother. All these lies to help her daughter get custody, even though she was a petitioner against her daughter, which was very contradictive.
For the two separate children, right? It was two different stories.
Right. This grandmother would walk into one courtroom and say, oh, no, she's terrible because she had custody of the other one. And then walk into our courtroom. Yeah. She's this great thing, you know. And the social workers did that, too. You know, the social workers did that in one courtroom. Brittany was a danger. But in the other courtroom in Avery's case in the other one's case, she was great. So, I mean, everything was this big ball of contradiction, but it was okay because we can never join those two cases in front of a judge.
It's so skewed in the wrong direction when it's a matter of introducing evidence to protect a child. It's, well, no, we really have to protect the mother's rights. But who's concerned about the child's rights besides you and, you know, the grandparents and other family members who really see what's going on?
Right. Because in the other child's case, luckily, they were all against the mother. But that was right across the hall from our case. And it was proceeding during the same time period.
And they couldn't have joined it under one judge. It just was.
They couldn't continue. Otherwise, the bad mother in this room wouldn't come over to this room and be good. So they had to keep them separated. So she looked good in one courtroom and bad in the other.
That's so bizarre. It's just so unbelievable. I mean, they valued one child's life over the other, or they just undervalued them both and hoped for the best. It's so strange.
The whole thing was very questionable, and their reasons behind it was even more so questionable. And of course, none of them would have an answer. None of them would say nothing. The last two chapters of the book is what wasn't said, what could have been said in a trial had we had a trial and things like that. You know, the first six chapters is all the history you need, but it's not the most important part. The most important part is those last two chapters.
You eventually were able to kind of dig some truth out of it.
Yes, with a lot of studying also.
Yeah.
I did a lot of background in researching and interviewing witnesses and things like that to put their statements in the book. There's a lot of evidence in there. And of course, I had to cover up their names, but there's so much information that it validates everything in the first six chapters. Wow. Because I didn't want to write anything for them to say, oh, you're lying. I wanted there to be proof in the book to say what I was saying was truthful.
And that's good. Yeah, that gives a lot more credibility. Because, you know, you don't want to be the person who wrote this crazy book making all these wild accusations. But if you have the evidence in there, it makes it very difficult for them to refute what you're saying.
Right. Yes.
It's really an admirable undertaking. You know, it's a very in-depth book. The detail is excellent. And it really is just stunning. Anyone who's even remotely interested in this topic mm-hmm. should read this book. And just so we have it out there, it is called
In the Best Interest of a Child. And it's on Amazon for Kindle. And I do have the audio that's coming out. And I do have some hard copies locally because I deliver those myself.
Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah. I mean, if anybody outside the area wants to read it, it's easy enough to get on Kindle. That's the way I picked it up. I was looking for an audio version as well. So that's great to know that's coming out.
Yeah, I've been working on a whole bunch of things with that. And I'm not a writer. I never claimed to be a writer. I've never wrote anything more than a letter.
Wow.
So it took a lot out of me because I wrote that story many times. I wrote it before she died because I wanted to do something to change her circumstances. And then when she did die, I dumped that whole thing. And then I wrote it many times until I finally came down with, you know what? This information came out of my diary. That's the way I'm going to write it. I'm going to put it back as a diary because that's the only way I could think to tell the story.
And it does come off very visceral in that way, which is probably the way it needs to be experienced, because to look at it from a clinical perspective is one thing, but to hear it and feel it from the perspective of someone who lived through it and tried her hardest to save Avery, to protect her. And it really is very emotionally taxing. I mean, I have had to put it down a couple of times and just breathe because it's so upsetting. And I give you a lot of credit for writing and rewriting and rewriting, let alone living through it all.
Yes. Yeah. It was hard.
Yeah.
It was very hard. My husband didn't even read it until it was all done and up for sale. But yeah, he didn't read it until then. I don't think he could have stood it. But not only did I write it, but I had to sit and do all the photographs to make sure they were visually displayed as well as they could be. I did the artwork.
Which is beautiful, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It was very taxing on me. There was many times I, too, had to just take a break because I would get so upset.
Yeah. And reliving the trauma has got to be very hard to do.
Yes, which I will probably till the day I die, because I'm not going to let this go.
It's got to be tough, especially on your psyche. It's just part of you now. You lived through it and now you found a purpose in it, which is wonderful. I hope that helps you heal somewhat.
It does. Sometimes I can, you know, talk like I'm talking to you right now, very nice and calm. And then sometimes it just gets me so angry. I try to control that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, especially since they learned how to use that against you. I imagine that's a lesson you learned, but it's just...
Oh yeah. I can't raise my voice or I'm not right.
Right. Heaven forbid your volume turn up a notch or two. I can't imagine how it wouldn't, honestly, in a situation like that, where this little girl is telling the truth and they're just finding every way around it.
Yes. And, You know, I pray you get through the rest of the book okay. I know you're heading towards number 40, and that was the hardest section for anybody to read.
Yeah, I hate to say I've been through a bunch of these types of stories, and they are all just gut-wrenching, but some have detail that's just, oh, it's so hard. And as a mother, it is very difficult to get through them sometimes, but I just feel very strongly about getting these kids' stories out there, and they deserve to be remembered. They didn't ask for this. They didn't do anything to deserve what happened to them. And Avery sounded like just a beautiful, angelic little girl.
She was, and she had no issues. She had no mental issues. She had no physical issues. She was just a well-rounded child that was highly advanced for her age. And when she died, you know, within an 18-month period, and this is what's sad, locally, 19 children died the same way with Child Protection Services involved from her death date. 19 children locally in 18 months.
Wow.
That's surreal.
It really is.
Yes.
And is it the same county or just affiliated CPS branches? Within
our same state. Actually, a news reporter wrote a story about 19 children. And I found out because Avery was part of that. And I'm like, 19 children, 18 months. This is crazy. And then as soon as she died, there was five more immediately after. So, and I don't know how many of them had affiliation to Child Protection Services, but I know the 19 children did. That is just too much of a coincidence. And they're always like, well, this one slipped through the system. Really? Did all 19 children slip through the system? Something's wrong.
It's just too much. You know, I think I found the article. I had bookmarked it the other day, and I have heard of a few of these kids, but nowhere near all of them. And that just doesn't seem fair.
Yes.
It seems unfair that some of them get so much attention and some stories go nationwide and some get Netflix documentaries and others just no one knows their name.
Nope. And I'm pushing. I don't know of any other child's story that has somebody that's driving so hard to not only get this child's story out, but to try to do something positive with it to help save other children that's in her same situation. I wish there was more. There's so many people on like yourself that tries to get these stories out there. So the unknown gets known because so many are lost. They right. just die and nobody remembers them. And we can't let that happen.
No, that's the tragedy right there is, you know, if the life had to be lost, then at the very least, we can talk about them and who they were as a person. They were people. They might have been 1, 2, 3, 4 years old, but they were little people. They had their personalities and they should not be forgotten for who they were. That's a very important part of it for me, making sure that we know who the child was.
Because they were our future at one time.
Yes.
And Child Protection Services and these parents have stolen parts of our future.
It is such a tragedy. And so many people want children and can't have them. And others just seem to have no problem whatsoever to just pop them out and then neglect or abuse them.
I never expected to be a mother of a baby again. And I was ready to set everything aside to do that because in my situation, I felt that I was the only one that was capable. Everybody had a situation they were dealing with that would have compromised, you know, the situation. I was the only one that I felt that could do it until maybe one of her parents would have become more stable. I doubt the mother would have ever because of all her issues, but her dad might have got to a more stable like he is now, very stable. Very capable.
Oh, good. But yeah, at least in the meantime, you know, you were her safe harbor. And it's just so sweet to hear, you know, the way she loved you and her pappy. And it's so cute.
That was her favorite. I don't care what people say. They were like, oh, I was her favorite. I'm telling you, her pappy was her favorite. Our cat Boogie. I know she knew she died because that cat don't make a sound. And in the night she was assaulted, and we didn't even know. That cat ran around the bed screaming.
Really?
Yep. And was like, what in the world's wrong with you? You know, this cat never made a noise. And that cat to this day will sit on my husband's lap and stare at him with that same admiration that Avery did. And it just takes your breath sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Because they were babies together.
Okay. So she grew up with the cat as well as her cousin in the house.
Yeah.
At least she had some semblance of stability. You know, in the time she was with you, she felt safe. And thank goodness for that.
She did feel safe. She felt very safe. And the only one she felt safest to tell all these bad things to was me. Because everybody else was, you know, fun. That was her fun person. But when it came to saying all the bad stuff, she would tell me.
So she really did feel that comfortable and that safe.
Yeah.
It means a lot. I mean, it must have been so hard to hear it all, but just knowing that she trusted you that much.
She did. But that's really hard to live with, too. And that's one of my worst burdens. Because before she died, we were sitting on swings and stuff. And she looked at me and she said, Mama, can you get me to the judge? I want to talk to the judge. I want to tell him mommy's bad. I want to come home. And I said, baby, you're not old enough. They're not going to listen to you. I said, if you could just hold on, because she was almost 5 years old. And I said, if you could just hold on a month or so, you know, you're going to be five. You know, maybe we could see if they'll listen to you. And she believed me and she trusted me and we didn't make it.
Well, there's no way you could have known that at the time. And, you know, she needed that, I think, to hear that someone was in her corner and going to try to help her.
Yeah.
It must be just very hard to live with. I'm sorry you've had to deal with all of this. It's just so ugly and it's a side of the world you don't ever want to see. But in a situation like this, you become an expert in things you never wanted to know about.
Yes. This was never my plan. This was not my retirement plan. No. But some things are bigger than yourself and you've got to listen and you got to do what you can. And I don't know if I can accomplish anything, but I'm going to try. I pray I can get the right person at the right time to listen, because I believe that these things that I have in the Avery statute, it would save children.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Avery and what she was like? I know you mentioned in the book that she loved bubble guppies.
Oh, yeah. Big blue basketballs.
There you go.
That was her favorite episode. Yeah, well, yeah, she had her routine here, you know, and we're very musical, and therefore she became very musical, and I have video of her at 1 year old playing the harmonica. Yes, and she could do that well, and she liked playing on the guitar and singing on a microphone, and she knew the words to the songs, and her favorite song was Radioactive by Imagine Dragons, and I had to put it on repeat. Anywhere we went in the car, it's like, Mama, Radioactive. But she called it Radioactive. Oh. Yeah. And in the summer, she would wear a bacon soup in her flip-flops.
Oh, a bacon soup.
Yeah. And she was always a big geel instead of a girl. So some of her language is the sweetest thing to remember. Just the way, yeah, she was. But yeah, we had a routine. She was reading. She was starting to write. She was so advanced. I mean, she died at 4 years old.
But she was already reading. That's great.
Yeah, reading and writing. Uh-huh.
So she loved to learn, I would imagine.
Well, I'm old, so I can't run around. my level of playing with her was teaching her stuff. And I also had her in a private preschool. So she was taught well, and then she had another step-grandmother or grandmother-to-be that loved her dearly, and she would sit and teach her. So, I mean, she had all these people helping her and teaching her, so I give credit to all of us to making a very well-advanced child.
Right, definitely, and she had to have that level of intelligence, too, so she just sounds like such a bright child.
Yes, and it's like, I'm religious. I think God said, you know what, you're not going to be able to help her and I'm not going to let her suffer. And I think he took her home. But I think she was here with purpose. I think her life was to propel maybe even me to do something to help all the rest of his children. So to me, I have to think her life had purpose.
Yeah, there's no way that she was here for no reason. She was here for a brief time, but she made a big impact.
Yes. And all the other children, you know, they're all safe together, even though they should never be that way. They right. should be in their beds, warm, taken care of, happy, playing, growing, but they're not.
Yeah. So it definitely helps to think of them safe in one better place. That's for sure. That's all we can really hope for. And then just keep their memories alive, keep their faces out there and their stories. And I'm just honored I've been able to help you to tell Avery's story.
I'm starting with my own little blogs on YouTube, and then I'm linking them to my I Stand for Abused Children Dear page on through my Facebook.
So yeah. I'll make sure to put all those links in there so everybody can follow and support. The more people know about it, the more they can pass it on and help.
And they can find out about more children, because I'm hooked to a couple different organizations that do these great things for these children. So if we can, you know, pass all that along, we'll keep these children's names alive.
I want to end this episode by paying tribute to Avery, who was her mama's cupcake and her pappy's deer. Avery Lee Delia Hobbs was a bright, beautiful, well-spoken little girl who loved spending time with her family, her pets, and her cousin and best friend, Lou. She loved the TV show Bubble Guppies and The Color Purple, and she was very musical and loved singing and playing instruments like the guitar and the harmonica. Tammy described her as
a little jokester
who
would just laugh wholeheartedly.
Avery was cherished by her father's side of the family. She was adored and doted on and very, very much loved, and she deserved protection. Rest well, Avery. We will never forget you. That's it for this week. Join me next week for another case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.